Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, September 25th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of political analysis, intellectual probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 gets you a digital subscription. $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
Hi, John.
And back with us after sustaining a popcorn oil-related injury last week that kept him on the sidelines, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
You make it sound so heroic.
He is bloodied but not bowed. Burned but not singed.
It's alliterative. I think you should go with burned.
Burned but not bowed. He is singed but not soulless. Or something like
that's
that.
That's debatable.
Judging from your Twitter feed this weekend, that is debatable, since many people have accused you of all sorts of terrible things for the fact that you took both the President of the United States and his liberal critics to task for engaging in culture warriorism over the deeply important central issue of our time, which is how one should behave on the sidelines of a football game during the playing of the national anthem, as almost 4 million Americans in Puerto Rico are subsisting in 95 degree heat with no electricity, people mired and trapped in buildings, an island property of the United States that has largely been destroyed by a hurricane that may be 6 months without power. The President of the United States spent the entire weekend getting into ridiculous fights about how multi-million dollar football players and billionaire NFL team owners should behave. Similarly, just as he spent days last week going to the UN, giving a good speech, talking about the threat, the global threat posed by North Korea and the simple model of deterrence that says that any imminent threat from North Korea to the mainland of the United States fundamentally means that we will destroy the country, which is what nuclear deterrence is, and then simultaneously undercuts his own efforts and his own effort to rally the world against this unique and unprecedented threat by using a belittling, silly nickname, calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man or Little Rocket Man, thus making him seem like a puny, insubstantial, and silly figure as opposed to, you know, a potential threat to hundreds of thousands of South Koreans, millions in Japan, and tens of millions in the United States. So the behavior of the President of the United States is baffling, unless you think that what's really most important is that he engage in and indulge in the spiritual exercise of polarizing America along culture lines for the benefit of his party, his cause, his effort to last-ditch effort to get health care passed or to push tax reform, how any of that, and to rally the world against North Korea to deal with the aftermath of the natural disasters of the last month, how any of that is strengthened by his efforts in this regard, eludes me. So maybe, Noah, you can lay out for us what happened this weekend, and then we can go from there.
Okay, so the president was in Alabama for a rally.
Friday night rally.
A Friday night rally for his embattled candidate to replace Jeff Sessions in the Senate. Formally, he's currently serving as on a temporary basis Luther Strange. He's in real trouble. And so the president went down there and said, rallying for Luther Strange, you know, I might have made a mistake. And you all should just go out and vote, and if you vote, I'll declare victory no matter what. But while he was basking in the adoration of his fan base, he stumbled onto the notion that NFL players should stand for the national anthem, recalling Colin Kaepernick, who famously, to protest police violence against African Americans, took a knee on the field. Many months ago. He is not in the NFL. His contract elapsed in March. No other team signed him. He's currently unemployed. This has not been an issue this season. Really wasn't even much of an issue last season. At least it's been a year, pretty much. And the president sort of exhumed this issue from its grave, ripped open the old wound, and had so much fun doing this and enjoyed the satisfaction of watching the left and the right go to their familiar corners and indulge in, you know, the performative aspects of this issue that they've been doing for the last year, that he spent the weekend attacking professional sports players, black professional sports players, who have done similar things protesting excessive police violence.
Not just
going back to
professional sports players. Not only Colin Kaepernick, whom I don't think he mentioned by name, but he did mention Stephen Curry of the used to be the Golden State Warriors. I can't even remember what the team is. Not having them come to the not having the team come to the White House because Stephen Curry had expressed some doubt about whether or not he wished to do so. But the issue that was raised was the president is polarizing the country along racial lines because he's attacking black athletes for protesting police brutality, you had this bizarre. Everyone retreated into their natural tribal camps, right? So we had liberal Twitter, let's say Twitter now being the place to gauge this most readily, which simply presumed that what the president had done here was so unspeakable, so horrible, so monstrous in every possible
and so
way.
Politically inept,
and so and that it was politically inept. It would cost him. What is he doing? This is crazy. Failing to take account of the fact that in 9 national polls measuring sentiment on this issue, the public opposes protesting during the national anthem, during sports events, either by a margin somewhere of 20 to 40% against, and clear majority supporting the notion that you should not do this. So, far from the president being inept and having awakened a sleeping giant, he's the one who was playing to majority public opinion, not they. And they think that they're playing to majority public opinion because they are living in this ludicrous, you know, liberal bubble that is more impermeable than the conservative bubble, though they love to talk about the conservative bubble.
Well, just
vastly more impermeable.
Real quick, it's not just the issue, but I do think there's consensus on the issue when it comes to race and police violence, but also that they believed that making adversaries out of professional athletes was just simply a bad tactical maneuver.
I don't believe that's right. I mean, I had an exchange with my old colleague John Cassidy, who was 20 years ago the business editor of the New York Post, is now one of the sort of chief economics writer for the New Yorker, an English immigrant to the United States, a very smart guy, very very left wing. So he said the president has been so stupid, and I said to him, what are you talking about? Like, that's ridiculous. Like, he's on the majority side of this issue. And he said, oh really? Well, you know, when you have Colin Kaepernick and Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, and John Mara, the owner of the New York Giants, against you, you're making a big mistake. And I'm like, oh, really? So you're talking about professional athletes who are in problematic odor in the United States, number one, and then NFL team owners who are sports team owners are popular. Are drivers of popular opinion in the United States? Do you think people like sports team owners? Where does anybody like a sports team? As far as I'm aware, sports team owners are probably among the least popular people in the United States. So he thought, wow, all these institutions are coming out against Trump, and that's ridiculous. Now, what is the real issue here? Why are we horrified by Trump's behavior? What is it that we're... What's he doing that makes it so bad?
Well, I mean, he's just bringing the institute, the presidency down so low. He's just further polarizing the country. He's not taking seriously the enormous threats that we now face, some of which you've covered already. You know, in terms of the natural disaster in Puerto Rico, in terms of Kim Jong-un. It's just a disaster. And the thing about it is that he's much punier than his enemies give him credit for being. They're inclined to say that he's sowing chaos and that he's further dividing us. It's true in a way, but he completely piggybacks off longstanding or even in this case dormant cultural issues just to get a rise out of the entire country. And watch, and part of the inducement to him is that he sees that everyone in the country reacts exactly as they can be expected to. It is such a huge master switch that he can throw to watch at both sides and the media completely respond to what he wants in the way he
right.
wants.
Well, so he is Pavlov and we are all the yeah. dogs, right? He is the, and he's one of Pavlov's dogs also in his own way.
That's right.
Because he is also responsive to the
whatever's on
to the sugar pellet or whatever else, whatever comes down the chute that Pavlov used to get the dogs to salivate. I would say that the real issue here is, should the President of the United States be complaining when citizens of the United States freely and nonviolently decide to express themselves in protest? The answer is no. The President of the United States should not do that. The President of the United States, the public is perfectly capable of making its mind up on its own about whether or not what Colin Kaepernick was doing by taking a knee was something that it supported or did not support. And I would say Kaepernick paid for his Kaepernick did something and he paid for his choice. I mean, granted, I think if he were the greatest quarterback in the world, I don't follow football very much anymore, but you know, I mean, if he were the greatest quarterback in the world, it wouldn't matter. And they would, you know, I mean, Michael Vick got a job back after being in prison for sponsoring dogfighting and all that. But you know, obviously teams feel like they can do without him, and they can do without him for two reasons. One of which is that they have quarterbacks they can rely on the one hand. On the other hand, they don't need him sowing dissension or making fans angry, and that whatever positives that he may present, the negatives are worse. So he expressed his opinion, and the market kind of responded with disincentives for others to do what they did. And so if Trump had kept his mouth shut, people wouldn't have been taking the knee on this Sunday to express solidarity with the idea that they should be allowed to express their political opinions freely.
Yeah, you know, a thought just occurred to me. So now that everyone is taking a knee in solidarity with these guys, isn't that sort of normalizing something that we were overwhelmingly horrified by only a few years ago? Sort of disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the national anthem, things like that. I mean, this is coming from the side that doesn't want to normalize aberrant behavior.
Well, that's why conservatives have taken the belief that this is good for Donald Trump, and they're examining it in a horse race sense. And I think that there's some emotion attached to that, because the right has been bitterly aggrieved by the cultural consensus on the left in sports media, in entertainment media, regarding issues like police brutality and pervasive racism in America and general over-policing, et cetera. And they consider Donald Trump, I suppose, to be a medium by which they can communicate these concerns to the press, even though what he's doing here is nakedly to his own benefit. It has no interest in the nation. He's only got the most tenuous grasp of patriotism in general. So they're just grasping at whatever flotsam they can in a shipwreck, I suppose. But why I had such a frustrating weekend this weekend, and why I was called racist rather repeatedly, is the notion that was really resented by the left, that theirs is a culture war too. For them, for people who are all of a sudden embracing Colin Kaepernick, who had no interest in wrapping their arms around him until Friday evening, this is an existential threat. This is about bloodletting in the streets, and for you to minimize that by calling it a culture war.
The existential threat here being police brutality and the...
Or over-policing in general.
Over-policing in general, right. So,
but what right. What makes it a culture war, and we understood this when Barack Obama weighed in on it, in which he did. In 2014, you know, he was talking to People magazine, talking about how LeBron James was really smart and courageous to be wearing a shirt with the alleged last words of Eric Garner a man who was choked to death by an NYPD officer in Staten Island for allegedly selling cigarettes when he shouldn't have been. Wearing those last words on a T-shirt, he was calling it courageous and saying, you know, this is the legacy of Muhammad Ali in when athletes have an impact on our politics. Conservatives remembered that that was inappropriate because it opened bitter wounds and it didn't do anything other than sate the demands of liberal commenters to hear Barack Obama talk about this sort of stuff because he had no legislative remedy. There was nothing the president or the federal government could do to address local police brutality save for enforce existing laws, which they did and which they do. It was a culture war because it was only about hearing the president emote about something. There wasn't anything on the table to address it legislatively, and there isn't now.
Okay, well, but
I think it's rightly falls in the category of culture because it's something that emerges from the culture. I mean, there are issues that are also, you know, things like abortion are also parts of the culture war, but they have legislative components. I mean, I don't think
things need a legislative component to be part of a culture war. You're talking literally about the spiritual condition of the country that is beyond simple political measures, right? So one of the things that is so frustrating to me about this is that everybody has the free speech that they like and then the free speech that they don't like. So conservatives now like free speech on campus, but they don't like it. They don't. You know, they want conservatives to be free to protest on campus, but football players shouldn't protest on a field. That's ridiculous. That is a ludicrous double standard. It's just that you like what conservatives are saying on campus, and you think, by the way, it's more important, obviously, that there be free speech on campus because that's where free inquiry and free thought take place and are supposed to be at their freest in order for intellectual activity to take place. But, you know, you pick and choose your favorite spot. So, you know, expressing horror at political injustice when it doesn't gore your ox, but you don't like it when it does gore your ox. Like that is the nature of where we are now. That's a classic emotional hypocrisy that all human beings engage in, but not to this naked and vulgar fashion.
Right. I mean, we've just come off a sort of season of conservatives saying, look, on the left, you are right to be disgusted by white nationalism and by neo-Nazis and the rest of it, but don't get this crazy idea in your head that you have to stifle free speech because of it. That has been exactly where we were up until this weekend.
So that's my particular, aside from the fact that it's ridiculous for the President of the United States to be indulging in this kind of fighting. I mean, okay, so Dan Quayle mentioned Murphy Brown, and people talk about violence on TV and programming, and there's talk about all of this stuff. And of course, you can't divorce what went on from the talk over the last month about the politicization of sports journalism, right? Or sports television journalism, in which you have commentators on ESPN essentially climbing up on soapboxes and yelling at everybody the way comedians now do on television, turning their perches into, you know, secular pulpits in which they speak about the virtue and horror of the world in which we live. All of which is very tiresome and is driving everybody insane because, like, there is no respite. There's no escape from the constant politicization of everything. And the constant politicization of everything, it is an interesting aspect of our culture war that the left, liberals and the left genuinely believe that the politicization of everything is a conservative disease, that, you know, they've politicized women's bodies and their rights of women, and they politicize this and they politicize that. And, you know, from looked at in another fashion, you know, you can't watch a football game without it becoming a giant political issue. Now, again, let's talk about hypocrisy here for a minute. The right on the left, if they were defiantly not taking a knee, or if they were singing the national anthem twice as loud because something had happened, you know, after 9/11 or some whatever, that would be fine, you know. If they, for most people, if if
Some on the left would call it chauvinism.
But celebrities and athletes are supported when they are supported by politically minded people when they express themselves in ways in which people that support your views, and you are contemptuous of them when they're not. And my view is that they're all mostly idiots, and they have the perfect right to speak, and they should be ignored. You know, George Clooney has the perfect right to speak, and he should be ignored. Why do we listen to George? Because he's handsome. Like, I don't need to listen. He's a director of bad movies and writes horrible screenplays, so he's maybe marginally more intelligent than many actors because he can at least put words to paper. But that doesn't mean that he's not an idiot. Similarly, most professional athletes have 1.3 grade point averages, and they can shut their mouth and not talk about things about which they don't know. The country is gifted, you know, they have gifts, they work in meritocratic situations in which they make lots of money, and they're threatened with terrible injury and all that, and they should just shut their mouths because they don't have to. They're perfectly free not to, but I don't need to listen to them. And the problem is that Donald Trump is making me listen to them, and the Democrats and liberals are making me listen to them, and they are driving me crazy. They are driving me crazy. I would rather listen to people who know what they're talking about instead of people who don't know what they're talking about. I don't need to go turn on Jimmy Kimmel to hear him give a speech about health care that was written for him by Chuck Schumer's office. I can listen to Chuck Schumer give a speech. That's what he's there for. Jimmy Kimmel is supposedly there for, these guys are in theory there for making us laugh, not giving us lectures. And the conversion of all of these spaces into, as I describe them, like secular churches in which these performers, either athletic or celebrity performers, act like they are spiritual leaders, spiritual and political leaders, is horrifying.
I have a question. It's not rhetorical. I genuinely don't know the answer. So we're talking about areas of the culture that are completely infused with politics, and it strikes me these are sort of left-wing dominated areas of the culture. We're talking about the entertainment industry primarily. But now what about those parts of the country? We spent some time in past podcasts talking about sort of there being two popular cultures. What about right-dominated popular culture? Like, is that politicized in the same way? For example, and I don't know the answer at all. For example, NASCAR. Right.
If you're from a conservative perspective, it's politicized. You're not allowed to engage in these kind of protests that we're seeing in the NFL, precisely as a response to the NFL.
Right. I mean, I would say that
is it preachy? I don't know at all.
It's the joke about NASCAR was always that politicians would show up at the Darlington County 500 and get booed, and it didn't matter who they were. They could be George Bush, George Bush Jr., George Bush Sr. Anybody, and they would get booed. There were 500,000 people there, and their role was to boo the politician, like the politician. So the audience is largely libertarian. I want to go back to something Noah said about Trump and patriotism. Trump won the election by explicitly running as a non-patriotic candidate in this regard, which was, who are we to go around and lecture? We invade countries. We do all this stuff. We're treating our people terribly. Our country is in terrible shape. Things are awful. And, our system is, everything is bad. And gave a speech at the Republican convention in 2016 that was a denunciation of the United States. So I would say that having him lecture me on what patriotism is a little offensive. I mean, it's fine. He represents a certain body of radical right-wing opinion that says that the country has been taken away and is no longer great and is problematic and our system is broken. That's fine. But then he doesn't get to wrap himself in the flag. Specifically, his effort to wrap himself in the flag is an effort to convert this view of the United States into the patriotic view of the United States, into the notion that we are not a force for good in the world, that we are not the freest country on earth, and that we do not have the system that represents the greatest political achievement of humankind. To pretend that you know, this is the higher patriotism, is to pretend similarly that that being nasty about the national anthem is the higher form of patriotism. They're just mirror images of each other.
Which is perhaps why they so resent one another. Because you really only see the differences in people who you most resemble.
Right. I mean, Donald Trump, who said when Bill O'Reilly asked him about the Russian...
In February as president,
said, what, are we so great? We don't kill people? You know, it's like Michael Corleone talking to his girlfriend Kay Adams. Like, this is ridiculous. But you know what's not ridiculous, you guys? I'll tell you what's not ridiculous. Tracker, our advertiser for this podcast. Tracker is a fantastic service. I just used it this weekend, as I'll talk about, because I have it attached to my keys, and I couldn't find my keys, and I took my phone, I pressed the button, and I found my keys because they set off a tone. It's a, you know, your phone, your wallet, your keys, they're hiding somewhere, you can't find them, they're trying to make you late. There's a ritual, you pat your pockets, you look in the drawer, you look in the change bowl, you look in, you know, then you go look in the, you think maybe you left them in the fridge, can't find them. So you know what you do? You buy Tracker, you get Tracker. It's a little dongle. You put it on something, and an app will make it ping, and then you hear it in the apartment, and you find it. So I did that this weekend with my keys. I was so thrilled because as I age, it gets worse and worse with me. I need to get more of them to put on more things because I just don't know. I just put things down. I just don't remember where they are anymore. 56 years old. It's just embarrassing. So 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the new all-tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you'll never worry about losing your things again. It's the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You place it on, like I did, on your keys, your wallet, your cat, your cat's, I don't have a cat, but I gather you could put it on your cat's collar. When you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert goes deep, 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 will help you find it in seconds. It has powerful LED lights, so you could find it in the dark. If you lose your phone, just press the button on your Tracker Pixel. You could do it in reverse, and your phone rings, even if it's on silent. You can even locate your item if it's miles away, because every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. It's like Waze for finding your things. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you have nothing to lose. So, go to thetracker.com. That's Thetracker. No E there. Thetracker.com. And use promo code commentary to get 20% off any order. Thetracker.com. Use promo code commentary for 20% off. And we thank Tracker for sponsoring the commentary podcast. Okay, now what we should talk? What should we talk about?
Well, you know what? You know what Trump did knock out of the news?
What's that?
Especially out of the Twitter sphere.
Yeah, what's that?
Valerie Plame.
Valerie Plame Wilson. So as you may or may not have noticed, Valerie Plame Wilson, former covert CIA operative working in the headquarters of the agency in 2002, married to former Ambassador Joseph C. Wilson, the 8th or the 16th or the 27th or whatever pretentious, pompous number this sorry, misbegotten excuse for a pompous human being has, was sent by the CIA to investigate the question of whether or not there was yellow cake, that Iraq had discussed yellow cake with Niger. Found, in fact, that Iraq had discussed yellow cake with Niger, then turned around and wrote told Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times that he had found no such thing, and then wrote a much-discussed op-ed in the New York Times in the summer of 2003 saying that there was no Iraqi trade in nuclear fissile material, and that this had been White House had known this because he had reported it to the CIA, which he had not, as the Senate Intelligence Committee uncovered. He had in fact said the opposite, But therefore the White House had deliberately lied to the American people. This was the beginning, really, of the we were being lied into war deliberately line. And an enraged Richard Armitage, number two guy to Colin Powell at the State Department, told a reporter that Wilson had been sent to Niger because his wife, Valerie Plame, had been the person that the CIA who sent them. Her name came out in public. It turned out that she was a covert agent and that it was against the law to reveal the name of a covert agent in public. A special prosecutor was appointed, Patrick Fitzgerald, with the end result that Scooter Libby, the chief of staff to Dick Cheney, was indicted and convicted of having lied about a meeting with Tim Russert of NBC News. Mind you, it is now clear that Scooter Libby never named Valerie Plame. It was Richard Armitage. Scooter had nothing to do with it. Scooter's a friend of mine. I will state that, stipulate that at the top. But he was, in fact, convicted, and George W. Bush commuted his sentence, and he did not serve any time in jail. Did not pardon him, but did commute a sentence. Joseph Wilson lied. Valerie Plame then went on to do whatever it is that Valerie Plame did for a living. She was photographed in Vanity Fair. They wrote a book together. Douglas Lyman made a movie out of it in which Naomi Watts played Valerie Plame and Sean Penn played Joseph C. Wilson, the 87th. That was all we heard about her. The movie tanked and they were no longer useful because George W. Bush was out of office and everybody understood that Wilson was a fraudulent idiot and Plame was useless. And then out of nowhere, this last week, she tweets out a piece about how Jews start all the wars in the world by one Philip Giraldi. Philip Giraldi, who writes often for the American Conservative and other places, is a former CIA agent himself, a conspiratorialist, anti-Semite, slime bucket of the lowest possible character, and whose material is often really vile and virulently anti-Semitic in that specific conspiratorial way. And then it turned out she'd been doing it over and over again. She'd done it three or four or five times. So what do we make of this?
it is a pretty prosecutorial case.
We told you so. She's bad news. He's bad news. And, you know.
Do you think anybody will go back over their frustration with, antipathy with the neoconservative elements of the Bush administration and their frustrations over the prospect of the Iraq War and the impetus behind the Iraq War in light of the notion that they are most likely harboring anti-Semitic theories? I mean, besides us.
Well, there was a little bit of it. I mean, I have to say, everybody on Twitter acknowledged that what Valerie Plame had done was disgusting.
Including Valerie Plame.
She apologized. She apologized 50 times.
Yeah. I had no idea that this article
talked
about how the Jews run
media. Then she said she
should
have known. She didn't know.
But by the way, after she had tweeted out, you know, sort of further defenses of it, saying,
don't read the piece. It's very flavorful.
Read it all the way through. Don't let your own biases get in the way of assessing the piece on its merits. Yeah. But I mean, look, there was always an element of the those who were against our going into Iraq that talked about it being a war for Israel.
And basically that this Jewish cabal led us into war. The Jewish cabal made up of Colin Powell, famous Jew, Condoleezza Rice, famous Jew, Donald Rumsfeld,
big Paul Wolfowitz was pulling everyone straight.
I know. No,
somehow.
George W. Bush. Heap big Jew.
Yeah.
Dick Cheney, daily, praise three times a day with a tallis and tefillin.
Did you mention Rumsfeld?
Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld, recently moved to the West Bank, with his 19 children to live on a settlement. I mean, yeah, so there was Paul Wolfowitz staying there in the, as Undersecretary of Defense. And, you know, the Jews lied us into war because basically, you know, the Gentiles were just robots working for Paul Wolfowitz. Mm-hmm. Paul Wolfowitz, a contributor commentary, very fine person, very intelligent person, knows a lot about a lot of things. I would not describe Paul Wolfowitz as the most horrifyingly manipulative, you know, sort of like a figure of such deep charisma and psychic power that his ability to mow down people like his boss, Donald Rumsfeld, who is not exactly a person easy to intimidate or to control. It was always just preposterous and ludicrous. And the fact that this was the line that was proffered was itself evidence of, you know, deep-seated, you know, a kind of deep-seated anti-Semitism in certain quarters, because it was so insanely ludicrous that on the one hand you had this most evangelical administration ever being controlled by the Jews.
But
revenge is a dish best served cold, and the humiliation and bringing down low of Valerie Plame is at least a tiny ray of light in a deeply gloomy political moment.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really did.
Yeah, you got to enjoy it. So what did we forget? North Korea. Can either of you guys explain to me or come up with a theory according to which Trump's decision to call Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man is...
Well, it's why he would do it if he's trying to make the case that, that he may be this enormous threat that brings us inevitably into a giant conflict. I have a theory, but it's your theory. You had said that sort of Trump acts off the cuff without any forethought and just says what feels good at the moment and what's likely to produce some sort of reaction that he wants. I think that's it.
It's precisely the same thing that brought him up to a stage in Alabama where he resurrected this controversy, this racially inflammatory controversy that had no other objective other than to inflame the audience, inflame the country, frustrate everybody, and redound to his benefit. He's got good political instincts when it comes to that, like how he gets himself in a position that is marginally beneficial among the people who voted for him. But everybody else he doesn't quite understand how to appeal to, and he does make the effort quite frequently to appeal to people on the left, the international community. He can't quite understand it. He knows how to play his quote-unquote bass like a fiddle. And that's instinctual. And when he listens to his instincts, he does really good. But he can't quite figure out how to make that apply to anyone else.
Right. Well, you know, he actually had a good couple of weeks. Every poll had him ticking up. He had a poll in which he was at 43, which would have been at the highest that he's been since
Inauguration
Day. Because
he wasn't being political. He was doing
political
stuff.
Well, he wasn't being
political.
And B, most importantly, he was out of the news. Like for a week, basically, we were following storms instead of Trump. Of course, he doesn't like that, because that's why he's president, is to be the dominating figure in the world. That's his, you know, ceaseless hunger. We also didn't discuss the collapse, the third apparent collapse of the healthcare. We're told it may not have collapsed. We're told that there's a new version and it could possibly get voted on. This does feel like some existential Charlie Brown and the football thing, though, right? I mean, so they lost once. They lost once in the House, and they brought it back in the Senate. Now they've lost twice in the Senate, and this is the third time. So they're really going to run up to the ball again. They're going to have a vote again. I guess they're not going to have a vote. Mitch McConnell will not bring it to
a vote. Not unless Murkowski drops her objections.
Right. Well, and we don't even know. I mean, there is no bill. That's, of course, the joke here, is that the bill is just, okay, the states all get it. You know, enough. Sei gesund. Here you go. You take it. You see what happens to it. The liberal attacks on this notion that you block grant health care to the states are hilarious, it seems to me. This notion, some organization announced that 34 million people would lose their health insurance, which, by the way, is insane, because all that would mean is that 34 million people would choose under these terms would choose not to pay for health insurance, not that they would lose it. They would still have access to it if their states would offer it, because they would have all this money to put it up. It's just that they would choose not to pay for it. which isn't a loss. That's a deliberate choice. But why is this happening again? I'm kind of at a loss.
Charles Grassley was pretty honest when he said that we made this promise, and it has less to do with the bill than the fact that we have this promise to keep, and we got to keep trying it. They're prisoners of their own words.
Now, I will say that there are a couple of interesting...
It's not as though it's not as though this isn't a pressing public policy issue, and that Obamacare is super great, and it's not having extraordinarily distorting effects on the insurance market and the economy more broadly.
Maybe they are going to run in 2018 by saying, look, we got the House, we got the Senate, we got the presidency, we were ready to move, and we couldn't pull it off because we needed... We didn't have total unanimity among Republicans, and we need 60 seats in order to do this. Or we need Democrats to come to our side. Or we tried. Don't say we didn't try. Maybe that's better than saying that they gave up. I don't know. I will say that one of the interesting data points is that the generic ballot, that is when you ask people who they'll vote for in the next election, the Democrat or the Republican, the generic ballot is not looking like it should, given Trump's unpopularity, the fact that it's a midterm election involving the out party and all of that. It looks like Democrats are up by about 8 points. You would think, based on all the data, that they would be up about 15 points in the generic, and maybe the country really doesn't like the Democrats either, you know? And so if they can't rally, I mean, what is it going to mean? They can't rally to win sufficient seats to take the House. They don't need that many. They need 24 seats.
It's still so premature to start handicapping November of next year, especially based on the generic ballot. I mean, you don't really even see what the landscape's going to look like for another 6 months. We don't even know who the candidates are.
Right. But I mean, we do know that there are general secular trends that happen over the course of time, and that... You know, the average net victory of the out party in a midterm election is 36 seats. Democrats should expect to win 36 seats, which would give them the House.
Is that average in this century? Because this century has had a lot of wild swings.
It's like 74. It's like the last 42 years, I believe. So how many elections? That's in House elections, that's 21 House elections. Like, that's a... Now, it's always buffeted by the fact that there are elections that are huge swings. You know, 74 was a huge swing, 80 was a huge swing, 94 was a huge swing, 2006 was a huge swing, 2010 was a huge swing. So some of that is a little distorted. Nonetheless, that's still a lot of elections even there, national elections. It's 6 or 7 data points. It's not a huge amount, but at least it does represent a trend. I don't know. It's very confusing.
I mean, what will that mean? It'll mean that the Democratic Party has a debilitating brand issue that they will be unable to address.
Well, look, I mean...
Because to address it would be to frustrate anybody else who calls themselves members of the Democratic base at this point.
Right. I mean, they have to make stark decisions. I mean, look, stay on the issue of health care. Where are they at? Are they pro-single payer or all the way now, or are they not? Are they talking about fixing Obamacare in you know, some smaller way?
I wrote about this on Wednesday, I think it was, with regard to Joe Biden coming out against the minimum income, which is something that really animates the left and also the kind of libertarian technocracy that wants to see the welfare state dissolve in favor of this more choice-oriented form of public sector charity. But the caveat is that we're going to dissolve all these welfare state programs in the form of pushing out a minimum income, and that's never going to happen. The Democrats will never allow that to happen. And Joe Biden comes out against this in favor of the traditional liberal opinion, which isn't really an argument against the right, it's an argument against the left, but for different reasons. When I was examining who's really for this thing on the left, who favor a minimum income, by the way, that you can live on, not just like a supplement, not 11 grand, but something really substantial, that they do this because they want to move past the labor era, where you had a backbone of the Democratic coalition that was represented by white working class people. And there's this big myth out there that Donald Trump won white working class voters. He didn't. He just won more than Republicans usually get. And the far left resents having to even appeal to those members of the coalition. They don't want Donald Trump voters back. They regard them as heretics, backward, unenthusiastic for the liberal project, people to be jettisoned, abandoned, shunned, and labeled as
right. So essentially, you're saying that this notion, which is that the government will supply every person in America with a guaranteed income. Charles Murray, among other people,
but he wants like $11,000,
it's $13,000, and the idea is that you will remove all welfare programs, and every American over the age of 18 will get a check for $13,000 a year from the government. Totally up to them how they spend it and whether they work to spend that. This should be enough to feed them and clothe them and house them. That's the idea, that they should be able on $13,000 a year to have a subsistence life in which they do not starve and in which they are not homeless.
The trade-off, Democrats used to give some feasibility to, at least lip service, was that we would scale back the entitlement state.
Right. No, and Charles's point is that this only works if you remove all welfare on the grounds that you need – this is such a disincentive to taking care of yourself, that if the safety net is broader than this $13,000 per person, it will destroy the country's, it will sap the country's will. But his point about this, which is an interesting philosophical point, is that the move toward higher levels of productivity, and in particular, this notion that we're going to move to driverless vehicles that are controlled by apps, will drastically limit the amount of unskilled work in the United States. That driving vehicles, for example, people who are employed driving vehicles make up about 6 million people in the world. I don't know what that is in the workforce. It's about 3.5 to 4%. And if driverless vehicles come in, this particular category, which is the most profitable form of unskilled labor, will disappear. And then what happens to those people? We're talking about 6 million people in the United States who will be unemployable because this is what they do and they can't do anything else. And so this is an effort to look ahead and try to think creatively about how to fix it. But you are right that what we have here is this notion that the radical left, which seems to be largely starting to drive the cultural and political conversation among the Democrats, is moving toward an anti-labor world in which, of course, the products of labor unions, aside from government unions, are polluting and destructive to the environment, right? Coal, steel, automobiles, things that where there is actually a working class labor world that is represented by, is unionized. So that's destructive. They're bad. The structural inequality in the United States means that you're a sucker if you work, because you're just working for some hedge fund that, is taking all your money away anyway. And that you have this law, the inevitable logic is somehow that, all we do is push people into working until they die, and that we should be more like Marx thought, which is that we should farm in the morning and, paint and write poetry. In the afternoon and the
evening.
That
was one of the liberal critics who I'd taken from Jacobin magazine, which is precisely...
Well, that's a left-wing Marxist
It's exactly as its name confers, if you remember what the Jacobins were all about. But yeah, her suggestion was that once we take away the labor element of this whole thing, then we reignite the debate over the nature of productive capital and who owns what and why we should dissociate the working class from the ruling class and all this Marxist prattle. But it's indicative of a little bit slightly elevated thought process on the left, which, as you say, does see work as exploitative. So to tie this whole the podcast thoughts together, we have a left wing that is being dominated by a cultural that is strangling it.
Or inclusive, increasingly guided, let's say, not dominated yet, but
well, right. Guided, I suppose. They are the animating ethos behind a culture that says we can't say that the flag is patriotic, because that would alienate and offend people for whom that is not their truth.
Right.
We can't say that work is not a four-letter word and that the American ethos of laboring to your own benefit and end is not an exploitative process, because for some it is. We can't say that police are good because they're not for everybody.
Right.
You know, Donald Trump couldn't ask for better adversaries. If you think that this presidency is going to be undone by that sort of cultural myopia, right, and animus, I got news for you.
And Stanley Greenberg, who was Bill Clinton's pollster, Greenberg Rossner Research, has a remarkable piece in the American Prospect called "How Hillary Lost" or "Why Hillary Lost" that I urge you to read. You can just Google Stanley Greenberg, "How or Why Hillary Lost." And you can read this description both of her book and largely of this book, Shattered, by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnas, about the disasters of the Hillary campaign. And what he says is that there was an institutional hostility to the idea that what Hillary needed was to generate votes among the white working class. This was not the ideological approach that this campaign wished to take. It wished to believe that it could knit together women voters driven by pro-women and feminist tendencies and African-American and minority voters, and that they would then pocket as much of the white working class as they would. But by leaning and waving in that direction, that they would somehow alienate this new base, this new Obama base, and that this was the malpractice, that they bought into this idea that the country had changed before it had changed and before it may even change, and that the appealing to the white working class in the United States is still the secret to winning national elections, period. That's what Greenberg says. It's what he said. It's how Bill Clinton won. It's how George Bush won. It's how Obama won. And it's how Trump won. And if you don't do it, you cannot win. And if the Democratic Party is doubling down on policies that go exactly in the opposite direction, this thing that you and I know wrote about, right after the Trump victory, this hollowing out of the Democratic Party, because increasingly the general public does not believe that the Democratic Party represents its interests, will continue apace.
I like that the left is hostile to the white working class and to manual labor and to the top 1%.
Right.
Right.
So
hostile.
So exactly. therefore the chattering classes.
That's
therefore
right.
Therefore public sector workers. That's and right. Therefore, well, you know, the app culture.
For the redistribution of capital and right. Really traditional Marxist ethos.
Right. But the traditional Marxist ethos was you redistribute capital to help the white, to help the working class.
Right.
Not to help.
Well, certainly.
Not to help adjunct professors who can't unionize.
And that's why, deep down, the minimum income offends most traditional liberals, because it is not targeted, because it is blanket, and you can't take your little constituent groups and benefit them disproportionately.
Right. Anyway, it's a sort of interesting larger political dynamic that was not particularly illuminated by this ridiculous kneeling or not kneeling an anthem moment.
The fun stuff was, by the way, that in 2012 Barack Obama's coalition or not, his campaign effort really ostentatiously flirted with the idea of jettisoning the white working class from the FDR-based New Deal coalition that had animated the Democratic Party. They didn't, but they made big gestures in the direction of it, and that really jazzed up the activist class to an extent that they're actually doing something now that they probably shouldn't have ever done, which is take him seriously.
Right. Now, I will say one thing. I watched last night Oprah Winfrey's first appearance as a contributor on 60 Minutes, speaking to a focus group assembled for her by Frank Luntz in Michigan of, voters in Michigan. And it was her in a room with 20 people talking about their various views and everything. And I said it jokingly, and I've said it not jokingly. I said, if she doesn't run, she is a fool. Because if you watch this 60-minute segment, you will see somebody who is the perfect Trump antidote, who can speak to people and hear people and make it appear as though she listens to people enough that she can take the other side of his bet. Go find it on CBSNews.com and take a watch and see if you agree with me. He's going to have to face down, if the Democrats are serious about beating him in 2020, he's going to have to face down a personality that can be in the arena with him. He cannot be a larger, bigger, more sizable, more, you know, grander, more controversial figure than the person that he is facing. Without, you know, if they want to win, they need somebody who can take him down. And like a mild governor of Colorado is not going to be that guy, is my opinion. Anyway, we are roasting Jonah Goldberg. Commentary Magazine's annual roast comes up November 7th here in New York. If you want to look into it and see if you want to come, it's not a cheap ticket, but it's a great event. Go to www.commentarymagazine.com/tickets. That's www.commentarymagazine.com/tickets. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.